Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Free State, everybody. Joe's already making gestures at me.
It's weird.
I was ready to go with my introduction, and then he started giving me the finger. On Bannerstrand in 2016, President Higgins described Roger Casement as not just a great Irish patriot. He was also one of the great humanitarians of the early 20th century, a man who is remembered fondly by so many people across the world for his courageous work in exposing the darkness that lay at the heart of European imperialism. Today we're going to talk about the lives, because there are many, many lives of Roger Casement. And to do that, we're joined by an old friend of mine, Roland Phillips, who has written a fantastic new biography of Roger Casement, Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement. Roland, welcome to Free State.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Why do you think there is this enduring fascination with Casement? Maybe even a greater fascination today than there was 100 years ago.
Because his life was so extraordinary, or his lives, as in the subtitle of my book, I think he had at least three distinct lives in the Congo and the Amazon, Irish, and then Irish nationalism and his execution, for which he was executed in the end. But I think the real reason, and the reason I wrote the book, is because he's such a modern figure. I think you can look at him again for every generation. And I felt that there was room for the book because he was 100 years ahead of many others in criticizing colonialism, the whole business surrounding his sexuality. I think we can only look at now in a dispassionate way that certainly didn't affect his lifetime. And he is, to my mind, he is a figure who would have been much happier today than in his own time.
Nobody will ever live a life like this again. I mean, it wouldn't be possible nowadays.
Absolutely right.
I mean, it's just when you read it, I mean, I just kept thinking of Peter O'Toole and Lawrence of Arabia. Orange, Orange. Yes. You know, and that matchless sense of a real life Indiana Jones, you know, embarking on adventures and you know, that strong humanitarian sense, you know, and that glorious romanticism. And I kept thinking as I was reading the book, because I know something of Casement. Obviously, Casement's a massive figure in Ireland, Casement Park, you know, his execution, you know, his gun runner, all those things. But I kept wondering why there hasn't been an epic sort of David Lean-style movie about his life. Because he was a marvellous-looking fella as well.
He was very handsome, beautiful voice. Everyone commented on his voice. It's interesting you bring up Lawrence of Arabia, because I take my title from something T.E. Lawrence said of him. Lawrence of Arabia was planning to write a biography of Casement shortly before he died. And he said in the letter saying this, he said, "I see him as a broken archangel." So there was a lot of affinity between the two of them. Yeah.
And there's lots of writers and poets who have been fascinated by Casement through the years, even at the time, like there was, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle was
Arthur Mark Conan Twain. Doyle was a huge supporter of his right through the worst of times. His trial, Conan Doyle put up half the money for his defence in his trial. James Joyce talks about him in Ulysses when they're around his birthplace. And Mario Vargas Llosa, the year he won the Nobel Prize, wrote a whole novel about Casement, fictionalization.
But did Doyle in any of his Sherlock Holmes stories manage to draw a character that might have had similarities with Casement?
No, I don't believe he did. Doyle was a huge supporter of the Congo reform movement. And even when Casement was at his lowest point, when he was in Germany at the end of the war, Doyle was saying he's just unwell from his time in Africa, he's still a great man, he's still... So he really believed in him to the end.
Yeah, he was so strong. I mean, the book, Broken Archangel, is really... It's a very beautiful book, and we're really delighted that you're here today. I just wanted to read maybe the opening to the book, which is so dramatic. The priest alongside him was struck by the almost regal dignity with which the tall man carried himself. Casement gave the responses to the litany for the dying firmly. He attended Mass in the prison at 7:30, received his first Holy Communion at the same time as his last rites. As he climbed the wooden steps, he looked up at the sky and remarked in his pleasant baritone, "It is a beautiful morning." And the book starts with his execution.
Yes, I wanted to start with his execution very briefly, it's a prologue, and then go straight back to Congo. Rather than doing his childhood up front, I want to do the Congo. So I hope the reader who doesn't know about Casement will ask, how did this man get from here to here?
And in a way, the very first page is the central theme of the book, you know, where you describe Casement's own reaction to the fact that he's now mounting the scaffold to be hanged. His own reaction was one of gentle incomprehension. He was puzzled as to why, quote, "anyone wants to hang one who never hurt a human being, whose heart was always compassionate and pitiful for the grief of others." And I think one of the most extraordinary pieces of information, which I wasn't aware of, that the prison authorities confiscated that last piece of writing. So fearful were they of the public reaction that might be caused if people were to read that.
Yes, he was a great hero, Casement. I mean, his work, his humanitarian work in the Congo and the Amazon had made him internationally, worldwide, a massive hero. And it's completely shocking to me that the British government did confiscate, even some of his letters to his closest friends written when he was in the condemned cell, they confiscated because they were terrified that they'd be used for propaganda. And the whole campaign to spare him execution, I mean, the Senate passed a resolution in the United States to spare him execution, and the Archbishop of Canterbury went to the Prime Minister and said spare him execution. And I could tell from the memos Prime Minister Asquith was writing to the Home Office that he was looking for any legal way out because he knew the damage that would be caused if he executed this hero.
And I suppose
saved the lives of millions of people.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that because we'll come back to the Irish element and his journey to Germany and that kind of which was the sort of apex of it, that romantic being, as you say. He's sort of, look, if he was always a romantic body, as Joe says, by the end he was almost pure emotion. There was no very little reason left in him. But you know, your book open, you know, after that chapter, your book opens with him sailing, getting on a ship at the age of 19, and flee. And you know, you say he needed these open spaces. He needed to get out of the claustrophobic world he had lived in Ireland, and then gone to Liverpool, I think. But what was his upbringing like? Because it was very, like, you know, today we would place so much significance on the kind of fractured upbringing that he had.
I think that's absolutely right. And I do think his upbringing was the key to his character, which in turn becomes the key to his actions. So his mother was a very shadowy figure to him. She died when he was 9. He always believed she died in childbirth, but her death certificate says she died of cirrhosis. So one might assume from that she was an alcoholic. She was a very absent presence, it seems to me. His father came from this reasonably well-known Antrim family, but and had a commission in the Indian Army, which he then sold mysteriously. Maybe he was alcoholic too. And he then took his family. Roger was the youngest of 4. And they lived in boarding houses in the outskirts of London and round the suburbs of Surrey. And they never had any money. There's some rather pathetic letters from his father to his prosperous uncles near Ballycastle, saying, could you send me £5? And if I'd had £5...
He was sort of neither Protestant or Catholic. He was a sort of a strange hodgepodge.
Yes, absolutely.
And ultimately seemed to be one of those people who, I suppose, very like T.E. Lawrence or Oscar Wilde, was just totally unanchored, ended up pursuing this totally original path.
Yes.
But his father had this incredibly heroic incident in his own life.
When he rode across Europe.
It's an extraordinary story. Tell this story.
it's a story. I couldn't find any backup for it.
but you went with it.
Don't spoil it.
He certainly told his children this, and it, I think, could have influenced Roger in his freedom-fighting mode, that his father went to Hungary during the Hungarian Revolution in the 1840s, and rode into Kossuth's camp. And Kossuth said, this is going to fail unless we get help from the British. And his father jumped back on his horse, rode across Europe and turned up at Prime Minister Palmerston's dinner table and said, you must send help. And many, many years later, he claimed that he was in Niagara Falls in North America, and Kossuth was passing by in a carriage and passed a note out saying, this is the man that saved the revolution.
It's incredible. Like, even I don't know how the time, you know, gallop, how long does it take to gallop across Europe?
But weeks, I should think. The his arrival as a very lowly clerk in the Congo, very lowly employee of the British Empire, and at that stage, you know, a very open mind. And then very quickly sees the rapaciousness of the various empirical powers. And then, of course, King Leopold, who is a sort of a delightful but horrifying venal pig in the book, and who decides that he is going to get it, that Belgium is going to get a piece of this action. And they're going to get it in the Congo because it was largely unexplored. And and I love this line. In one of the more murderous ironies of history, the Belgian king understood that any territory belonging to tiny Belgium had to be presented as a largely humanitarian venture. So, and he proceeds to wreak a genocide on those people that was...
So he played his cousins, the British, the French, the Germans, all of whom had empires in Africa or colonies in Africa. He played them off against each other. None of them wanted the other to have more land in Africa. He sponsored Stanley to explore Belgium, the Congo and the Congo Basin in particular, and then wangled it in a international conference in 1885, control of the Congo on the grounds that it would be a free state and that there would be free trade, that the Congolese would prosper from Belgium's rule over it, or Leopold's own rule, in fact, because he ruled it directly. And
it was quite extraordinary. I mean, he got the blessing of the Society of the Red Cross. He described the mission as founding a chain of hospitals and hospices, hospitable and scientific. Yeah. And within a very short period of time, once the deal was done, I mean, his first official decree was that all Congolese would, for at least 7 years, be slaves to the Belgian Empire.
Absolutely. And when he took over the colony, and this is where Casement worked, he did indeed build the railway, but it was mainly to do with ivory trading. But then as the demand for rubber rocketed around the world because of it was needed for electrical cabling when electricity came in, and then above all for car tyres and so on. So there's a huge demand for rubber, and the Congo Basin had vast natural resources of rubber, and King Leopold became, as you say, completely venal.
I mean, totally disgusting. I mean, some of the descriptions in the book are, if I might say so, matchless. I mean, this man who loved his food to the extent that he'd been known to order his next meal in Parisian restaurants before he'd finished the current one, let it be known that his finances were in such a dire condition that he would in future consume one less course at lunch.
Yes.
I mean, before the sort of Congolese adventure started to...
Absolutely. He was unbelievably greedy. He was very jealous, as I say, of the bigger powers. Belgium was quite a new country. It hadn't been around for 60 years. And he was determined that he should be as rich as his cousins on the thrones of Germany and France.
But the lengths they went to, the exploitation and violence in pursuit of rubber then was...
Yes, he set up a private army called the Force Publique, and they controlled the exploitation of rubber, which in those days they hadn't planted rubber trees, so they were getting rubber from the natural vines which were in the jungle. They're incredibly difficult to tap. You had to climb them to tap them, and then they died, unlike trees which would renew themselves. So they were driving the workers ever deeper into the Congo jungle, worse and worse conditions to get less rubber. And if the Force Publique took the line that if the workers weren't producing enough rubber per day, they could kill them. And
absolutely grotesque.
And let alone they emptied out the villages, they demanded other people fed everyone, and there were stories of villages just decimated. But what's worse and worse is there were so many millions of people in this industry that they decreed that only one bullet could be used for each person killed. And to prove they killed the person, they would cut off their hand and bring it back so they could count the hands and count the bullets.
I mean, one of the more ghoulish sort of tableaus in the book is the 200 hands of boys in the wheelbarrow.
Yes,
absolutely. You know, I mean, the absolute contempt for human life and the venality of all. I mean, you paint, I think, brilliantly that picture of it's almost like Saigon in the 70s, you know, for the white Europeans who are arriving there. This is a playground for them to indulge the worst excesses of human beings, you know, prostitutes shooting the locals, you know, the casual barbarism.
You say European, in fact they made very sure that other than missionaries, and the only Europeans coming in were Belgians. That was one of the way kept the...
And where is Casement in this then? What is...
So Casement, who's been there almost from the start, is a sort of surveyor, maybe a bit of a trader. He works in a mission station for some years. But after a time, the point being that he really gets to know the people, the country, he can speak a lot of the languages, he understands the country, at which point he becomes a consul, a diplomat, because it's a steady job, unlike the other jobs. And I also think partly in the back of his mind was he could do something about this. And indeed, when international pressure began to build, because these stories were coming out of the mission statements and the stations, and there was a British soldier who was executed by the Belgians, which was a bit of an incident, and the British decided that they...
Yeah, like never mind a million Congolese, but if a British soldier was killed...
Exactly. They decided that they needed a report on what was going on. So they commissioned Casement in at the beginning of 1903 to write this report. And they couldn't have made a better choice because, as I say, he knew his way around. And he set off on this voyage in July 1903, where he went further up the Congo River than anyone else had been. And above all, he got the trust of people who'd survived this. And bear in mind, he met a lot of people and he took some photographs of some of them, which are in the book.
This is the kids with no hands
cut off, which meant, and they told him that because they were assumed to be dead, they played dead while their hands were severed.
I mean, the strong feeling that comes out, you know, from it is that he very quickly, like, it is extraordinary, the parallels with Lawrence. Like, he very quickly distinguished himself as a sort of a mythical figure in the Congo. I mean, and again, I cannot commend the book highly enough. We were talking about this just before you came in. I mean, one of the first things that he did that distinguished himself and that reverberated around the Congo was that he became the first white man to swim the 100 yards of the Nkisi River, which was notorious for its hidden whirlpools and killer crocodiles.
Absolutely. He was a passionate... In his 2 years, the only settled time of his upbringing was his 2 years after his father died, when he was in Antrim with his great uncles, between the ages of 13 and 15. And he swam whenever he could, but...
But when you go and see...
There's not many crocodiles in North Antrim.
When you go and see his statue, which I drove by today on the way out here, it's had a great new swimming spot in Dunleary.
Isn't it beautiful? But, and that sort of idea of, you know, the local people, then, because they realised very quickly, you know, he walked amongst them without a guard. He learned their language.
Yes.
You know, he adapted very quickly to this. He had no preconceptions. He had no bias or prejudice. Yeah. You know, he was so widely revered as he tried to improve the lives of the Congolese. They gave him the name Swama Casement, Woman's God, and Mona Fumo Casement, Son of a King.
Yes.
And when that sort of set the...
Yes, and when he was on this journey for his report, they would... Initially, having been quite reticent, he so gained everyone's trust, their descriptions of them paddling after his boat and saying, tell my story, because everyone turned to him. He was an extraordinary... He was a man of astonishing compassion and openness and emotion, and people always... And sympathy for the oppressed, of course, and made people just want to tell him.
And courage.
And the courage. Moving thing about when we'll come to this, but when he was sentenced to death, like, you know, among the people pleading for clemency were, you know, there was like black organizations saying, because this is a man who had actually championed people in the Congo.
Yes.
You know, we have to stand up. We have to stand beside him at this point.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Point. But the other thing about that report was did he anticipate the pushback there was going to be, because the thoroughness of it was exceptional. Like, you talk about how far he went. Yeah. You know, into the Congo, but in every aspect, he got corroborating evidence. He said pictures. He did so much to make sure that nobody could discredit it.
That's right, and he got incredibly upset because the government, to protect these people, these Congolese, changed their names. They just put initials in their names, and Casement's rage and grief at this. Because he felt he was letting down the people by having them anonymized, and couldn't understand that this was for their own protection, was extraordinary. So much that he sort of taken them into himself. But then he also, after he delivered the report, the terrible rage that things didn't change at once, because, of course, international proceedings take time, and it wasn't till 3 or 4 years later that the Congo was finally taken away from Leopold, or he was forced to sell it.
After his palaces had been built?
After his palace had been built.
And he had married his 16-year-old prostitute girlfriend.
Exactly. And he
sold Leo.
He sold it to Belgium for millions and millions.
But what was the scene, can I just, I wanted to go this before we move to the next phase. Because, again, this was another early example that you give, which is incomparable. It was whenever he was, you know, making his way through these uncharted territories, and he was surrounded by a tribe of sort of bloodthirsty local warriors who seized some of the people with him and clashed swords and machetes in his face and yielded when they realised that this was having no effect on him whatsoever, that he was entirely calm and relaxed about this.
Yes.
And ended up in conversation with them. You say, you know, they were granted a brief palaver and he was allowed to continue on his way. Yeah. But that, I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yes.
To think that in the face of that, he was completely relaxed.
He was, because he got to know that he had these palaver, there's a memorable couple of weeks when Joseph Conrad encounters him on Conrad's second day in the Congo as a steamboat captain, and they spend 3 weeks together. Conrad hadn't published a word. Nobody had heard of him. He had his Polish name. And Conrad reports in his diary of Casement striding off alone into the bush with a dog. And having palavers, which is where the word comes from.
And a lot of these tribes were cannibals as well.
Yes, they were.
So, I mean, they were.
He was fearless. He was absolutely fearless, and just wanted to.
But you talked about his frustration when the report was published. What was the impact of that report? Because it still had a huge effect.
It had a huge effect. That was. Worldwide had an effect. It had an enormous effect in America, in particular with what was then called the Negro Fellowship, and the ultimate effect was that the European powers forced Leopold to sell his colony, give up his control, and there was sort of proper international oversight of it, and that was the end of the atrocities.
But they also tried to, but Leopold tried to discredit it first as well, and there was...
Leopold, yes, he had paid journalists, one who lived in London, who wrote for the Times. Leopold was paying this person the equivalent of about £100,000 a year nowadays, to write articles about how marvellous Belgian rule in the Congo was, and he did several ripostes. Mark Twain was a huge supporter of Casement and wrote King Leopold's Soliloquy, which was a sort of savage parody.
It's only Twain could.
Using Casement's report of what Leopold was doing. So the report did get the international movement going, but ultimately Casement was still very frustrated that it didn't go soon enough.
But again, when you talk about him as a modern figure, even in that, even the way it was tried to discredit it, there's something very modern about that too, and how they, you know, they talked about it being a Protestant plot.
Absolutely right, yes.
Discredit Catholic Belgium,
yes.
All that kind of stuff, which is very modern as well.
Very, yes, absolutely right.
That sort of, you know, conspicuous courage, like, which is very, very rare. Mm. Especially, you know, you get these courage, you know, you get people of courage who you know, are pathological or very attracted to violence, things like that. But he was none of that.
No.
You know, wasn't that he wasn't capable of it. And I wondered if a lot, you know, that sort of courage that he had was bound up with that, again, a bit like Lawrence, a bit like Wilde, that sort of hidden, that secret sexuality of his, which was his alone. And in a way, it forced him to plough his own furrow. He couldn't be open about himself, his deepest self.
I think that's a very, very good point. And I think that it's also bound up in his upbringing that I think he didn't have, we might now say, proper nurture. And everything was about giving out emotion rather than reason. Conrad said at the end of his life, after they'd spent this time together, and Conrad obviously through Heart of Darkness and so on had paid a lot of attention to Congo, Conrad said he is a man who's made his way by sheer emotionalism. And that is my sense. And I think the romanticism is a part of that. So in my opinion, this courage comes from total pouring out of emotion towards the oppressed. And when he was in that mode, nothing sort of...
He didn't look around corners.
No, he didn't look around corners. Yeah. He didn't think, I'm putting myself in a really dangerous situation. He just thought, I have to help these people.
But yet a curious feature of that, in spite of his secrecy about his sexuality, is how much detail there actually is in the book about it. You know, I mean, you describe his frequent sexual encounters being laid out boldly in his journals. The first one, I mean, it's just such lovely turns of phrase, and it just seems, I'm just going to read this passage. The first was on the 20th of February. It was the young man named Arthur whom he had met at the sailor's home in London. Arthur's penis was monene, and taken manua ami, very big, and taken in the mouth in the disguise of the Congolese Kikongo language. You know, surprisingly unsecretive.
His journals, we only have his 1903 diary for that period. And they're not... We'll obviously talk about them later in more detail, perhaps. But they're very brief entries. Yeah. They have no emotion attached at all. But he did.
And he liked to establish penis size.
Yes,
that's my most amazing feature. Either in inches or by a brief description, such as enormous. Yeah. So possibly the journal was to serve as a reminder of this. And I don't know if you saw the piece in, you know, one of our more reputable newspapers this week, the Sunday World. That Irish men apparently have the smallest average penis size in Europe, which
Roland, remember which, we said beforehand that you had to be prepared for anything.
I want to ask Roland's opinion on this. So I had this idea when the first question that came to my mind was how they could possibly know that, and I had this idea in my mind of, like, you know, the census takers travelling Ireland with a tape measure, knocking on the door and say, "Oh, sir, we're here to measure your penis, perhaps if you're, you know," saying, and then, you know, collating all of that data. And of it, you'd have to do it in all of the European countries, but I have to say, I don't know about you, Dias, where you know, but no one has ever asked to measure mine. So, you know, maybe...
I'm sure it's self-declared.
It's a know, bit... I'm not sure about the research that went into that Sunday World piece, but what a coincidence.
And how is... Here what, we, and we're segueing from this how?
Because he liked to measure the size
and now we move out
of young men's penises.
He did. Yeah, but as I said, you haven't answered my question how we move on from this, because we're trapped now in a conversation.
One more thing about
it's that delicacy of private life that we see with a lot of these great romantic heroes of that era.
For a man of such emotion, these diaries are completely unemotional. I mean, they're transactional, these sexual encounters.
Is it because he lacks the capacity for intimacy? He's great at the grand gesture, but when it comes to the private,
I think
that's a struggle.
That may be a part of it. But I think it just didn't occur. Very few men in that period, homosexual men, had romantic relationships, as far as I can tell, and from my research into 19th century attitudes to homosexuality. And indeed, it's noticeable. I mean, so these diaries feel to me like the fulfilling of a physical urge, frequently, for Casement. But he did only have the one romantic relationship, and what a disaster that was.
Yeah, we'll get into that, because that was Christensen, who was, as you say, the most intense, fulfilling, treacherous, and occasionally farcical relationship was like. And nobody who had any ability to look round corners could have got into that relationship, because the guy was clearly...
Everyone was telling him. I mean, the German, his friends in Germany were saying, give up this man, he's doing you terrible harm.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Flimsy staying slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's ARMODILO.com, and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo. Built to last. Designed to impress.